nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So this is the final lecture for gate dielectric breakdown. And we'll be talking about thick dielectric, or at least in the last class, we talked about the defect formation in thick dielectric, and I told you about lightening and dielectric breakdown in various types of polymers. And one thing we immediately noticed was that the breakdown voltage or breakdown field strength of the material was somewhat lower. And today, I want to attribute to that lowering of the breakdown strength to the intrinsic inherent process-induced defects in the dielectric itself. So that's what the last lecture is all about. Remember, everything that we have done from lecture 21 to lecture 29, we assume the original material is perfect. There's no intrinsic defect, no E' center to begin with, and everything is generated in response to the applied voltage, applied temperature, and so on and so forth. But, of course, no material is perfect, and now it will be essential that we account for it before we leave this topic. So I'll have essentially four things. I'll try to introduce you, remind you that what is the broad picture, and then very simply we'll again use the cell percolation or box percolation model to show that when you have defects in thin oxides, 1 nanometer, 2 nanometer oxides, what is the implication? And the most important implication there is that the weighable distribution will no longer remain weighable. And I will give you a simple example, simple calculation to show you what the deviation is going to be. Any deviation, any significant deviation from the weighable indicates the existence of pre-existing defect, that there are some defects to begin with, and then you are generating on top of it. And that's why there is this damages. The weighable is no longer a straight line. But equally important, I'll talk about this notion of pre-existing defects in thick dielectric. There is a topic of fracture mechanics. You know, the topic essentially says that any material you take, essentially it breaks a little bit earlier than its perfect strength, what it would be. And fracture mechanics essentially relates that early breakdown or lowering of the strength to the pre-existing defects. That's why an aircraft has to be so carefully checked for defects, because if there is defects which is slightly bigger than the critical size, the aircraft will immediately have to be replaced, because that may give rise to early failure, and we'll try to give the explanation associated with it, and then I'll conclude. But the conclusion also has an interesting part, and I'll tell you about the water and dielectric breakdown in water. But when you try to pull water, why does it come off so nicely? When you press water down, it's very hard. Compressive strength, it's incompressible fluid. But take a glass of water, turn it upside down, the water falls out. It should not fall out. And I'll explain the physics of it in terms of pre-existing defects. Just to remind you that where we ended in the last lecture, and in the last lecture we derived a relationship between the dielectric of a given value, of specific dielectric, and related it to the band gap of the material, the optical phonon frequency of the material, as well as the effective mass associated with the material. Why optical phonon? Because that is the amount of energy it lost every time it's scattered with phonon. Why band gap? Because you need a certain amount of energy, band gap amount of energy, so that you can do impact ionization and create new defects. And so therefore, we did a simple tabulation, and we found for when the band gap is small, the correspondence is relatively good. But when the band gap becomes very large, for some reason, then it looks like the match is not perfect. And even for the smaller band gap, it was not perfect. It's always off by 50% or a factor of 2. Gave a good initial estimate, but was not perfect. So we'd like to see what happened. What happened? Can we make the correspondence better? Now, where does pre-existing defects come from? The pre-existing defects may come from processing and during assembly. For example, for a thin dielectric, gate dielectric, one thing that the dielectric you have to do when you do the processing is the following. Let's say you make the transistors, you deposit silicon, you deposit silicon dioxide, you make all those things, and then, of course, you have to put down the interconnects. But when you are putting down these interconnects, you have a thin layer of metal, let's say, and then you have to etch the metal to define the lines through which it would be connected. You cannot have metal everywhere. And one way people would do that is by plasma etching. And what I want to tell you, that plasma etching leads to pre-existing defects in the following way. So how does a plasma etcher generally work? This is a cartoon view of how a plasma etcher works. It is exactly like gas dielectric breakdown. So did you remember in the last class we talked about that when you have a container full of gas and then you apply a certain voltage, Paschen's law describes the voltage at which it will break down. And it simply means that the positive charges, the ions, will move in one direction and the negative charges will move in the other direction. And when it impacts, if you put a substrate here, this used to be anode or cathode, and when it hits the substrate, if you place the material, it is going to etch off material. It's going to take off material. So any place where you do not protect it, it is going to etch down vertically because it's very energetic and it could be chemically active. So it etches down. And if you do not, for example, this open white box on the bottom blue, you assume that on the left of this white box and on the right of that white box is protected by somehow. And then in the etching then occurs wherever it is exposed. Now, how does etching actually work? What happens that if you have everywhere completely protected, then essentially if you have any oxide within the blue region, within the wafer, it will not know anything until, of course, the plasma etcher has been turned on. Once the plasma etcher is turned on, then what will happen? If this is an insulator, if this is a blue region is an insulator, charge will gradually build up because it cannot go anywhere. So therefore, charge will gradually build up on one contact. The other one will essentially escape through the other top electrode, right? Charge will gradually build up. Now, of course, charge cannot build up infinitely. And so the only way charge can escape is the following. Assume within the blue region, you really have a transistor with a dielectric. Then what is going to happen? And assume the bottom is grounded. So you have an insulator in the blue region, a thin insulator in the blue region, and the other side is grounded, which is shown on the right-hand side. And it is color-coded to reflect the following fact that on the bottom side, on the right-hand side, things are grounded. And so it is whatever potential it is to begin with. Now, this blue region is the dielectric, let's say. So therefore, in principle, there should not be any current through it. Zero bias, there wouldn't be any current through it. But what will happen as the electrons gradually build up in this region, then as the charge essentially build up, the potential will begin to float down, right? As the charges are building up, it's going to float down until the ionic current equals the whole current, because what is going to do, the ions are going to be neutralized by the electrons, and in response, hole will start going in the other direction and gradually build up the holes in here. And the field, it will enhance the field until electron current begins to tunnel through the oxide so that there is current continuity. Now electron will recombine with the holes. So the ionic current will flow up to the point on the substrate. Hole current will flow in the substrate itself. And then the electron current and hole current will recombine. So this is how the current continuity will occur. Because at the end, current must be continuous in a plasma etcher. It cannot build up indefinitely. Now think about the oxide. The oxide has not been used by a single day by any of you, let's say, this oxide. It is just being made by Intel or TSMC. They're just making it. And already, think about the tremendous amount of stress and the stress current that has flows to the oxide before the computer has been assembled. Processing, during processing, electrons, significant number of electrons have tunneled through the oxide. And of course, as a result, there'd be defects created in it, right? So this would be called a plasma enhanced defect generation or plasma etching related defect generation. And in the various processing steps, you always have defects formation like this. And there is another place where defects may form. Let's say for some way you have made a system which doesn't have any defect formation during processing. No plasma-induced damage or anything. Even in that case, there'll be defect formation. When an IC is assembled on a board, on an IC board, on a motherboard, then of course you know that these each pin has to be connected to the relevant ground, right? For example, I have here three input pins and three output pins and a VDD and a VSS. Those must be connected to the motherboard. Now, when you are connecting these boards, then of course somebody has to touch it. It may either be a person who has to go in and solder these things down, or it could be a machine which will come in and essentially solder these things down. Now, when you do that, just like any time in the winter days, when you walk up on a carpet and touch the knob of a door, then we get a jolt, right? Why do we get a jolt? Because our body builds up a certain amount of voltage and that's discharged through that ground. And similarly, exactly the same thing will happen. That essentially, because either a human being, whatever charge it has, that charge will get discharged through that IC, or a machine, a robot, when it touches it, in that case, charge, it will discharge through it. So there are, in fact, standard models for a human body or machine that one has to essentially know how much charge you're expecting. And that could be the same for any of the pins. It could be the input and output. What's wrong? The thing that is wrong is that I have shown you inside the IC a MOSFET. The input pins are connected to the gate of the transistor, right? That's how the electrons, they will turn things on and off. And similarly, the output pins are connected to the drain of a transistor of some sort so that it can drive output load. Now, what happens when you have on the input signal a certain amount of charge which is placed on the gate of a transistor, huge amount of transient current will temporarily flow through that oxide, thereby creating pre-existing defects. So this is an assembly-induced pre-existing defects because electrons will flow just like you have a jolt. And in fact, if you are not careful, if the machine isn't well grounded and well done, all your IC in the batch will all come out dead because it will break all the input. It will damage all the input pins. And so these are called ESD or electrostatic discharge. And people do various things. They might put a capacitor around it. So when you have high voltage, the capacitor turns on. And therefore, instead of the high voltage passing through the IC, it may bypass through another capacitor and go to the ground, thereby save your transistor. So there are similarly ESD circuits in the input and output to bypass the signal so that it doesn't go. Once the certain critical voltage has been exceeded, it doesn't go to the IC, but rather goes directly to the ground. Of course, there is a penalty to be paid because in that case, that makes the, if you hang an IC like that, then it makes the overall circuit slower. So therefore, it protects the initial circuit, but makes the final circuit or final product slower. So you have to be careful. So this is called ESD breakdown or ESD damage, again, creating pre-existing defects. What is the implication of these pre-existing defects as far as gate dielectric breakdown is concerned? Let's assume that we have that original oxide, which has M on one side and N on the other side. M is proportional to the thickness, N is proportional to the area of the dielectric. Now, in this particular case, previously when he did the analysis, I did not have any defects to begin with. It was a clean slate. And then we had the defects form one after another, and then the red boxes formed the percolation path. In this case, it's different. In this case, I have put crosses on different cells to indicate that even before any voltage has been applied by the user, or by us, or the machine has, or the transistor has been operated at all, even before that, there are some boxes which are already occupied, reflecting the fact that these might be damaged during plasma etching, or this might have been damaged due to ESD during that. And because those things are very small times, so it's not completely shorted. Small times, right? Because plasma damage, you are not going to put it for the whole day, for whatever duration you want to do the plasma etching. ESD is a transient pulse. It will actually go away within a microsecond. So therefore, it's not like you're doing 10 years worth of ESD. Then everybody is dead. So therefore, you have a few crosses already populating your boxes. The question you want to ask is that when will this oxide break, given this pre-existing configuration? Now, it may sound complicated, but of course, nothing is complicated once you think about it properly. You see, the way I should think about this problem, I should think about each column as if they are independent. I have like columns, independent columns, which can move around. Like a shell game, I can move things around. And the strategy of moving things around would be the following. That all the ones, that columns that doesn't have any defect, I move those columns to the left. And I say their number is N0. Then everybody that has one defect, I move them next. And you can see I have next in the right-hand column, I have four columns that has single crosses. So I put them all. So in that case, in order for the breakdown to complete, instead of requiring M defects to line up, I will need M minus one defect to line up, because I already have something from before. Similarly, you can see the next columns have two defects. So therefore, I would need M minus two, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, you can find out the total failure probability that none of the defect column has been shorted completely. So here is the result. I have to write a series. Probability of not failing is 1 minus F. So how many ways you can not fail? You can not fail if 1 minus F, M equals 0. M equals 0 means this doesn't have any defect. Those columns don't have any defect. How many defects would you need in order for it to slow? You have N0 number of columns. In none of the N0 number of columns containing zero defect will have to fail. In that case, the whole thing will not fail. So you get the idea. If you need N1 number of cells that contain one defect, then F failure probability of columns with one defect multiplied by N1, and so on and so forth. You can see this series will keep going. What is the maximum value of this series? What is the maximum value of this series? M, what is the maximum value of M? M minus 1. Because of course, if it is M, then you are dead to begin with. So therefore, that doesn't count. All right, so now the rules are simple. All you have to do is to remember that when you do not have any defects, small m is equal to 0, then the probability that a column fails is q to the power m. Q is the probability of trap generation, and you need m of them to line up. Similarly, if you already have one, it will be qm minus 1, and so on and so forth. And so you will have this particular values. Now, if you take a log, you know the products become a sum when you take a log, right? You remember that. And that if you take a minus sign, everything, so you are essentially expanding it out, right? So if you take a log, it will be N0 log of 1 minus Qm. That will be the first term. Now, when Qm is small, right? Because these are vertical columns. When Qm is small, log of 1 minus x, what is that? Minus x, right? And so therefore, that is the q to the power m. And the minus sign has moved to the left-hand side. And I could do the same for everyone. Now, of course, I have to stop at this point because I have to make another assumption because I cannot proceed any further if I don't make that assumption. My assumption is that the number of damages, number of pre-existing defect is relatively small. Because if it had a lot of defects to begin with, there's no chance that it is going to survive 10 years. So by definition, those are excluded because it will fail within a very short period of time. So therefore, I assume that N1, N2, and N3 are relatively small compared to N0, the undamaged section. So it's mostly undamaged, but there are some damages in some of the cells. Let's make that assumption. If the assumption is wrong, then the whole analysis is unnecessary because you are dead to begin with. If you are alive, then this is true. So you can pull N0 Q to the power M and that will essentially make one plus small quantity squared, small quantity cubed in that series. So why am I doing this? Because I want to create a variable. So I'll take another log. So if you took another log, in that case, if I can expand it in small quantities, then I will be in a good shape. So I have taken another log. The small quantities are given by red. The red ones, N1 divided by N0 1 over QQ is not the charge. Not the charge. It is defect generation probability, right? Q is T to the power alpha. And so therefore, again, log of 1 plus x, you can expand it out. And once you expand it out, what you immediately see, that the first two terms, the blue terms, log of N0, that gives you area scaling. Beta log of T divided by eta naught, that's from the perfect section, the section that doesn't have any defect. And N1 divided by N0, that one is associated with those that have a single defect, and so on and so forth. You will have two defects, three defects, with subsequent terms in the series. But do you immediately see that this will violate the variable? If you needed the variable to be perfectly satisfied, all the terms in red should have been zero, because then the variable plotted against log of t would have been a straight line. Now, it's not going to be a straight line because there's a time dependence in the red, 1 over t. Where is it coming from? Of course, you can check it out when you do the math on your own. And then, once you have done this, you can immediately see that the word intrinsic here, so I'm plotting variable as a function of log of time. The blue line is intrinsic. Intrinsic means defect-free. In the beginning, having no defects whatsoever. And we know the variable slope characterizes the slope of this line, which is the beta, which is still fine. But as soon as you have some pre-existing defects, if you plot it, the plot will be a red curve. It is, towards the end, looks like a variable with a slightly lower mean time to failure. But more importantly, it has the probability, some of it actually fails very, very early. That is the tail, fat tail of the tail of the red line, right? It fails early. Do you understand why? Physically, why? Forget about math. Why? The reason is that when you have one defect in some cells, some columns, two defects, three defects in some other columns, accidentally, some of them that has three pre-existing defects will require M minus 3. And if that lines up, those will immediately fail. Those don't need M defects to line up, M minus 3 defects to line up. So all the ones which are intrinsically weak, all the columns which are intrinsically weak, those would fail fast at much earlier time than the rest. Once those are taken care of, then gradually the slope becomes similar to the intrinsic variable. Why? Because if the failure is essentially in the defect-free columns, then you don't care. It's the same as before, except that the effective area is a little bit smaller, and therefore it shifts the whole curve towards the left. And you can do a failure rate or failure probability, which is given by the failure as a function of time divided by the 1 minus f, the number that did not fail. This is a quantity I will discuss later, but this is sort of a rate of failure in some way given a certain amount of time. This is essentially instantaneous slope of the rate curve. Yes?
Shouldn't the extrinsic case be just the intrinsic case minus the shift of time, because the defects don't know whether, even in intrinsic case, the defects don't know whether those were pre-existing or caused by stress.
Right.
So, shouldn't it just be a shift by some time rather than...
It is, in some sense, you are right. So, what he is saying, you understood his question, it's a very nice question. He is saying, let us assume that I start with a clean slate, and then I generate some defects in the normal case. And then I stop. I close my eyes up to that point, and then I say my new time starts from, let's say, 1 second or 2 seconds, because then whatever is the remaining, that's the pre-existing defects. And therefore, you are absolutely right that at the end of the day, this is essentially t minus alpha. That is what is getting. It's a log of t minus t naught. That is how much it has been shifted by. And all the rate curves that you have are essentially the expansion of that t minus t naught. Now, when you put that expansion on a variable slope, if you take a variable and make the t zero a slightly different point, you will get the rate curve. So your physical intuition is exactly right. So this derivative, localized derivative called lambda, is sort of explains that what is the defect or what is the failure probability. And you can see for the blue, essentially initial defect failure probability, intrinsic devices is very low. And of course, over time it accumulates defects, and therefore towards the end, the blue curve shoots up, indicating the fact that over the years, just like a person, even if a person is born defect-free, no problem. Over time, of course, there are damages. And when you get old, of course, the failure probability, meaning probability to die, goes up very, very quickly. On the other hand, the rate curve has a name. It is, first of all, it's called a extrinsic breakdown. And it is characterized by this distribution. What does this distribution remind you of? If anybody takes showers, then you should know what this should remind you of. This is a bathtub and this is called a bathtub curve. And a bathtub curve has one region with very high defect failure probability. And then, of course, some places where the initial ones are not, has got all the initial ones that are supposed to fail has failed. And then statistically, then of course over time, the defects build up due to stress, due to voltage and temperature, and therefore it fails again, a slightly lower value. Now the initial part of the breakdown, the left-hand side of the bathtub curve is called infant mortality. And the idea is that if a child is born with defects to begin with, of course there's a higher probability of dying early and as an infant. And therefore, essentially, this extrinsic curve will be replicated in all areas of science and medicine and in all areas. And in particular, you can see as the medicine improves, generally the left-hand side of the bathtub curve gradually goes down to the blue curve, because with vaccination and other things, for example. So there's nothing sort of fundamental. This is one way of generating the bathtub curve for thin oxides. Of course, for other problems, you will write a different set of equations and you will get the curve. Yes?
What is the reason the probability, the intrinsic probability higher than
exchange probability.
Higher? What do you mean higher? Here's.
Yes, more.
Here?
No. That point. No. Just before. Yeah, that point.
At this point?
Yeah.
So this is a cartoon. This is a PowerPoint at 11 o'clock in the night. And so therefore, there is no a priori reason. Take a derivative and get whatever curve you're supposed to get. And then, and in fact, you have a homework. And so, so what people like actually do many times is that they will do a burn-in. And burn-in simply means that they will take the ICs and then stress it a little bit. The ones that fail very early, they will be screened out. And therefore, you can essentially get rid of the weak ones so that, like, you know, the Spartans used to throw their weak children from the cliff so that only the strong ones survive. So that will be called a burn-in. And burn-in essentially allows you to send products out which doesn't have early breakdown. But of course, the burn-in itself damages the ones which was not damaged to begin with. So in fact, burn-in has this. It's a two-edged sword that essentially does this, screens the weak one, but also damages the strong one. So you want to do it carefully. All right, so let me go to the theory of pre-existing defects in thick oxides now. So first of all, this thick oxides, this has many analogies. The first analogy is Da Vinci used to experiment with the strength of wire. As he was hanging many pictures and other things, he needed the strength of wire. And it turns out that the longer the wire, less is his strength. And he found that out. And that he could attribute is to the intrinsic effect. Because longer the wire you have, more is the probability that you'll have a larger size defect. I'll explain that in a sec. Galileo, after his trial, you know, there Galileo had a trial, and he wrote a very nice book, and the book was called Two Sciences. One science is, of course, about gravitation and all those things, but the other was the fracture strength, because he was in Venice, and many times the main concern was many of the ship which was sent out, you know, this is a ship. They used to have a lot of trading. They used to fracture immediately. And of course, the Venetian merchants were very interested in making ships who wouldn't fracture immediately, because that would be a loss of a lot of money. And his book, essentially, thinks about two problems, and fracture is one of them. In World War II, they first started making this welded ship. Previously, there was rivets in the ship. And they started by welding, because they needed for World War II a lot of ship. The Japanese and Germans were making it very fast. So they wanted to make it very fast. So they did welded parts. And they made 4,700 of them. 1,200 of them were severely damaged once they started. 200 of them fractured so that it could not be used. And 10 in the middle of the night essentially split into two. So the idea was, and I'll explain that again, this has to do with pre-existing defects and crack propagation. If you weld it, the crack begins to propagate from one plate to the next. If you weld it, then the fracture is stopped. And so therefore, welding is a dangerous business. And there is a plane disaster. This is called comet disaster. Again, there you can see that next time you are in the plane, look at the rivets next to the window, and they used to make square windows in those days. And essentially crack propagated from that square window. And it took actually about 4 years before they found out the cause, because planes were flying, dropping from the sky left and right. And it is only after those disasters that the airline industry shift from UK to US, because UK was the king at that time in 1950s and after this comet disaster. So everything I'm going to tell you, if you pay attention, you will understand why all these things happened. So the idea is that if you have critical size pre-existing defects in a bulk material, then it will lead to dramatic failure of the strength of materials. So that's my goal of the next eight slides. So this is what I want to explain to you. Assume that you have a capacitor, 0 volt grounded and V volts on the top electrode, just like the last case. Last time I showed you a movie, and in the movie I showed that these are constant voltage lines. Each one of them constant voltage lines. So if it's 0 volt and the top one is 10 volt, so this first line would be 1 volt, 2 volt, 3 volt and so on and so forth. Assume that now you have a defect. And the defect is shown here in blue, and assume that it's a metallic defect of some sort within the dielectric. Now you can immediately see that electric field is given by the gradient of the potential with respect to the vertical distance. So if you have 1 volt between the parallel lines and then you divide by 1 centimeter, let's say the successive lines are separated by 1 centimeter, that gives you the electric field. Now do you immediately see that on top of the blue lines, the electric field has been squished? And that means the field, the potential, constant potential contours are closer by. And so therefore, the electric field, the red lines at the red points, the electric field will be higher. Of course, at the blue points, the electric field will reduce at the blue points, right? Along the blue arrow, because they are farther apart. But it will be squished close to the top of that defect, and that will create a higher electric field. Do you now immediately realize that whatever is the dielectric strength of the original material, because of that inclusion, the electric field is higher, and therefore, defect may form there faster than compared to the rest of the device. The voltage across the capacitor may not be anywhere close to the breakdown voltage, but next to the inclusion, now there will be voltage, will be high enough to initiate defect creation. Now, of course, a material doesn't have one defect. It's a bulk material, big material. It has many defects. So the question is, which one are most detrimental? Should we worry about circular defect? Or should we worry about the defects which are elongated? Elongated in one direction and all. And the x-axis in the vertical direction, and y-axis, I'm defining it, along the electrode itself. Now, can you tell me, just by looking at the picture, which one would be the most detrimental?
Elongated.
The elongated ones, skinny elongated ones, because that they will punch the electrostatic field the strongest, and therefore the electric field will be maximized. So if I could somehow calculate statistically the number of such skinny elongated or ellipsoidal like defects, if I could calculate somehow, then I'll be able to say that what would be the breakdown strength of this dielectric in the presence of these blue pre-existing defects. So you can take one of them, and it turns out that you will do this as a part of your homework, that you can immediately show that if in the absence of the blue inclusion, the voltage went from certain V to zero in the top plate. I'm sorry, I should have really done it upside down. My top plate is V actually, but the way I have drawn the picture, I've started V from the bottom plate. Doesn't matter. You get the idea. And that would have been the blue line in the absence of any defect, right? Because the voltage would go from zero to V. In the presence of the defects, what will happen that within the defect itself, it's like a metallic inclusion, let's say. In that case, there will not be any voltage drop through the metal. And so therefore, the red line has a middle section, which is essentially flat because there is no voltage drop within the metal itself. But just below and just above the inclusion, the electric field will be enhanced. And you can see the area under the two curves, the curves has to be the same. I'm sorry. If you get the electric field, how do you get the electric field? You take the derivative of the potential, you get the electric field. In the absence of any inclusion, the electric field was constant everywhere in the capacitor. In the presence of that inclusion or presence of the defect, near the defect on the bottom and the top part, the electric field, the red line, has increased. Now, do you see the area under the red line and under the blue line for the electric field has to be the same? Why? Because, of course, the area under the curve is the potential, and your top and bottom potential has remained unchanged. And so, therefore, the blue curve on the right electric field, they will be the same. So you can easily do a calculation of the enhancement of the electric field shown on the red plots. And the electric field you can show is actually given by defect-free electric field, E naught, 1 plus Lx divided by Ly. What is Lx? Lx is the elongation in the x direction, and Ly is the elongation of the skinniness in the y direction. So, as you just told me, that if it is skinny on the y direction, then it is most damaging. So, my goal would be, I mean, in general, the most damaging defects will be where you have small Ly and big Lx. That will be the most damaging. And of course, you can just represent this Ly with respect to the curvature of the ellipsoid. And so, therefore, I write it as square root of Lx divided by rho. As I said, you'll do it in the homework, and you can show that rho, the ellipticity, is given by Li squared divided by Lx. You can find it out. It's just an ellipse problem. And so, therefore, my bottom line is that if you have 1 over rho large, which is very sharp corners, then, of course, your local electric field would be very, very high. And the field could be so high, if the rho is very small, then you can neglect the 1. 1 doesn't matter anymore, because you're not really looking everywhere else. You're just looking at that point, because that's the most susceptible point. So I drop that n, and it becomes Lx divided by rho. Rho is the shape. And what is P? P is the probability of defects forming within this material. What is the probability that you will have one of those defects that has size Lx in one side? What is the probability? So I'll have to calculate those probabilities. Now, do you see the connection? That what is it doing in terms of, you have probably understood the electric field essentially goes up, but you could have explained it in many other ways. Assume that you have a two-dimensional resistor network. If you essentially remove one of the resistors shown here in the white star, then what will happen is that the current through the remaining resistors in that row will go up. And because it will go up, if you have one of the resistors that are supposed to burn, that will burn there the fastest, right? That makes perfect sense, because the current has to be continuous. And in the bottom, you have 4 resistors supporting the current, 1/4 the current going through it. On that one that is on the second row from the top, you have 3 resistors supporting it. So therefore, the current will be 33% more going through that. And so therefore, those will burn first. This is the essence of what a defect does to an oxide. And so only thing you care about is that what is the size of the defects. And the larger the size of the defects, more is the enhancement. Current enhancement in this particular case, potential enhancement in the previous case. All right. So let's see how can I calculate the size of this inclusion, probability of this inclusion. So assume that you have some random defects, small microscopic defects. Of course, some of them will be too small, isolated, with having 1 defects to begin with. Some, like the green, will have many, because these are all connected. Some, like yellow, will be a little big. It is 2. But the 2 on the top yellow, doesn't matter, because they are looking in the wrong direction. They are looking horizontally. The ones that are most damaging would be the 2 yellows on the left-hand side, which is looking vertical, because those ones have wrong aspect ratio. The 2 on the top in the yellow, those are along the constant potential line. So it doesn't matter how long or how short they are not really causing any problem. So how do you calculate? My goal is to calculate, given a probability P, my goal is to calculate how many of different shapes object can I have. So what is the probability of it is completely isolated? The probability is, probability P of having a sub-defect, it is P is the center one that is occupied, and how many must be unoccupied for this to be singly occupied? The neighbors should be all unoccupied. So that will be 1 minus p to the power 4, right? What is the probability that this should occur? Can you calculate that? It will be p squared, right? And 1 minus p to the power what? 6. But you have two configurations. They can sort of lie down or stand up. And so there you say that 2 is over there. And so the bigger it gets, the 2 in the prefactor, that will get, because different configurations are possible. For example, this one. If you have 3, of course you can lie down or stand up. Let's stand up is the first one. Lie down is the second one. P cube. And then you have, what do you have? P8. So it's always twice the number plus 2. Right? Twice the number plus 2. Whatever it is, you have 3. And then number of unoccupied is 8. So it's twice the number plus 2. Because plus 2 will be on the top and the bottom.
But we said that the ones that are, you know, aligned in this
way. Doesn't matter. Yeah, yeah. I'm saying, but, yeah. So, but I'm just counting. You know. So that's fine. You have p to the power cube, p cube, 1 minus p to the power 8. So it will be 2 times 3 plus 2. So that's not a problem. But of course, there are many ways. You don't have to, there's intermediate positions. You don't have to always stand up or lie down. You can sit, for example. So if you are sitting to the left, that's one configuration. If you're sitting to the right, you're sitting upside down or hanging upside down. So there are all sorts of other configurations you can do. And of course, there'll be corresponding things for that one also. You'll have a p cube, but then you'll have 1 minus p to the power 7. When the shapes are contorted, then you don't need 8, but you need 7. And then you have 4 configurations associated. And you can keep doing this. In fact, people have done this for 25 by hand. 25 of this, and they are correct. I can only do things when computed. So I checked whether their formula is correct, and their formulas are correct. Some of them has 485 terms, and they are all done by hand, and those are correct. This is called mathematicians and patience. So you have a size. You see, I'm trying to get a size. Given a probability P, if I want to have a defect of size S, 3 or 2 or 1 or whatever, then I will have a prefactor that is governed by the shape of it, and I will have p to the power s and 1 minus p to the power t. T could be twice s plus 2 or twice s plus 1 and so on and so forth. So, my goal is to calculate the probability of having longish defects, because those will actually cause breakdown. So, let's see. So in general, if you want to know that probability of a defect of size LX, LX number of defects on the top and one skinny one on the side in the LY direction, then you will do PLX and 2LX plus 2, because that's the 8 that I talked about. Now, the P is small, right? Probability in the analysis is small. And so therefore, you drop the second term and you stay with L square p to the power LX. Now, of course, you can exactly calculate the ones that I did before, the expression that I had. If you plot it in a MATLAB, the blue one will give you the probability of a single defect. The red one will give you a probability of the two yellows sitting horizontally or vertically, and so on and so forth. You can do it, and you can plot all of them, and that will give you the probability of having a defect of size LX given the individual occupation probabilities P, because random. Why is random? Because the process, when you did this processing, these were independently, randomly distributed. Only randomly, it got collected at a point to form a bigger defect. And so, from that, you can find out what is the average size of defects. Average size of the defect given a material of length L. And probability, defect probability of P. So you can calculate from here that if your process is very, very good, then your P will be very small, right? And then in that case, LX will be small. Remember, P is always less than 1. So when you have 10 to the power minus 5, that's a good thing, because you divide with 5, log of 5, right? So smaller things will make the defect size is small. Makes sense, because you have few defects that are randomly distributed. All right. So let's see whether we can go this. So therefore, do you remember that formula? The local enhancement of the electric field is given by E, Lx divided by rho. I neglected that plus 1 to begin with. And that's equal to the breakdown field. Now the Lx, I just calculated from the random percolation theory what this is all about. And so therefore, I can use the first expression to relate the Lx to the breakdown voltage. So the E breakdown, by the way, the E naught is V applied divided by L. The voltage that you have applied across the capacitor divided by L. And so from here, you can calculate that given a probability P and given a curvature rho, curvature in this case, you have Lx in one direction, in the vertical direction, 1 in the other direction. And so you can calculate rho. Then longer is the sample, just like Leonardo da Vinci. He had longer and longer wires. Then it will fail faster. Instead of voltage, it was load in that case. So it fails faster. Shorter the length, probability of finding a bigger defect is small. And so therefore, the breakdown voltage is actually relatively larger, proportionally larger. And if you make it go to infinity, the sample size infinity, of course there will be always a defect which is very large. And in that case, the breakdown voltage for those ones would be equal to 0. And so this is something people have numerically validated by a lot of through modeling, simulation, and experiments. People have actually found out the breakdown voltage as a function of the probability of defect inclusion. So P small being, it's normalized. It should be normalized. P small being, good process. P large being, bad process. Lot of pre-existing defects. And do you see this 1 over P relationship? Actually, it goes under log of P relationship. So you will have the corresponding inverse dependence on the pre-existing defects. All right. So let's see. So if you don't have 1. Whatever I calculated was just for 1. But you have a set. So if you have a set, then the failure probability. Do you remember this formula where I looked at the failure probability as a product of a set of failure probabilities? When did I do that? When I was looking into thin oxides, do you remember the columns? A set of columns were defect-free. If the set of columns had defect of size 1, Lx was 1. A set of columns had defect of size 2. And so therefore, we did the multiplication, probability of this multiplication. And therefore, if those values are small, remember we did this multiplication and expansion over there for small fi. Can I multiply it out? So let's see whether this makes sense. When you multiply a bunch of things out, do you see how that 1 minus the sum will come? Because F1 multiplied by F2, those will be even smaller. So all the product terms will disappear. Only the first order term will remain. And if the first order term remains, you can always put it up on the top of the exponential, right? Because e to the power x is 1 minus x. So you can do that. And therefore, all the failure fractions, Fi, you can sum it up as area multiplied by a geometry factor. And I'll calculate the geometry factor in a second. And so this has to be calculated. And because for each one of the sizes, the breakdown voltage will be slightly different. So the failure probability Fi, those when you sum it up, that's essentially all the defects summed up, failure probability due to that. And that will be equal to G1. So we'll calculate what the G1 is all about. But before you do that, if you take a double log, again, because we want to get to the variable slope, you see that there is a log of A, which is the area scaling. Once again, bigger things fail fast and smaller area fails later, right? That's because, and also you can see that that's related to the sizes, because bigger things will have more defects and therefore they will fail fast. So the area scaling by itself is not a proof that that this particular weighable relationship is satisfied. And then you have a log of G1E. So let's calculate log of G1E. So what I have shown you before is that G1 of E, the size distribution, is given by P to the power LX, 1 minus P, 2X, 2LX plus 2. That is the P cube plus 1 minus P to the power 8 for a size of 3. Now it turns out that as the probability increases, the curve or the size increases as the L becomes larger and larger, at the percolation threshold, meaning that when the defect size is about, defect probability is about 1/3 or so, then instead of writing that curve, P to the power X 1 minus P, you can simply write it as LX minus 2, tau is 2. And if you do that, let's assume that this can be approximated as such. Then what you find that you can just insert then. If you insert this LX in here, because LX, this one is already, we have calculated this already. If you insert it in LX over tau, then you will get an expression for G in terms of the eccentricity, the rho, and the original electric field, right? And the tau is equal to 2. And so this is sort of the numerically. If it's a numerically, people do show that this defect size distribution, when you have a lot of defects, the defect size distribution goes as 1 over LX squared. Means the smaller defects are many. So that's this red curve is trying to show you. Smaller, not too long defects are many. Longish defects are few. Because it's more difficult to form the longish. And if you plot the number of small defects, S is the size, number of small defects versus the number of large defects, the probability will gradually go down. That's the essence of all this. So once you plot this, again, do the W, put the previous expression, and hopefully you can do it at home. Then you can relate this E naught to V applied divided by L. By the way, EBD is the breakdown voltage without any defects. That's the intrinsic breakdown voltage. Now, if you plot it, you will have a curve something like this. So you will have a curve which will be a straight line on a W versus not time plot. What is the x-axis now? The x-axis is the electric field. So not time, because previously we talked about time. Now the ones that have a lot of defects, long defects, the probability is few, but they will fail the fastest. And then if you increase the P even more, if the P is decreased, then the probability of forming long defects will be fewer and the magenta curve will become vertical. And if you had no defects whatsoever, then you will have a vertical line. And what will be the voltage at that point? That will be equal to EBD. That will be the breakdown voltage. If you have no defects whatsoever, that means it's not weakened at all. And the magenta curve and the red curve is showing you, because of the pre-existing defects, how the effective applied voltage has been enhanced by those defects and it has failed before what it should have, the ideally where it should have failed before. So this is how it works. Assume that you have a set of oxides. And shown here, for example, how many? 12. There are 12 oxides, let's say. And you do a ramp voltage test, which means that you connect it up with a voltmeter or a voltage source and then keep increasing the voltage relatively fast. Then whenever the first one fails, the voltage at wherever the first one fails, you record that voltage, not the time. because it's all ramping up fast. So not the time, but the voltage at which that one fails. Which one will fail the fast? We will fail fast. The one that has the longest defect. The red one that has the longest defect, that will fail fast. Then the oxides that will fail will be the oxide that has a slightly smaller defects, which is the blue ones. It's a slightly smaller than the red ones. So therefore, those will fail next. But remember, their number is larger, given by the blue point, blue circle, because their numbers are larger. So there'll be more oxides with that size, but this will have a slightly higher breakdown voltage. And then you have much smaller sized, which are the magenta ones. Many of them, but they have the breakdown voltage almost close to the perfect ones. And so, that is how, so you ordered them, let's say, you have this one, the red one fails the first, smallest breakdown voltage. Then, you have the blue ones failing next, that has a slightly larger breakdown voltage. And there are many of them, so in the Weibull curve, therefore, they essentially moved up. And then, in the third size, you have many of them, but the voltage is close to the ideal one. And so, that's the magenta line. And that's where this line comes from. And therefore, if you don't have these long defects, then the whole curves will gradually move to the right. Right? And if you don't have any defects, then that will be a vertical line. So, just to summarize this lecture then, the basic steps are thin and thick oxide. We do the same physics, very similar physics of defect formation. But the main defects, the main differences are that there are many extrinsic defects in bulk dielectric. What is the reason? Because you cannot do in a perfect chamber, gradually in a pure chamber, gradually deposit these things. Most of them are chemically deposited or electrochemically plated or from a sol gel or a mixture, you make this polymer dielectric, right? You cannot put it in a sophisticated ALD machine to grow them line by line, layer by layer, because that will take forever. And so therefore, there are many extrinsic defects, and that those defects are then reduce the breakdown voltage. And the second thing I explained to you is why the breakdown in thick dielectric is correlated. Because the local enhancement of the electric field forces the neighbors to break faster than the things that are far apart. And this is very important. The oxides essentially often have, thick dielectric, have significantly lower breakdown voltage than what you'd ideally expect. And so therefore, in this case, this is similar, very similar to the fracture mechanics. Fracture mechanics also focuses on pre-existing defect as a key ingredient of the theory. Because if you don't know the distribution of the pre-existing defects, you essentially don't even touch the subject because there's nothing called a perfect material. On the other hand, for thin dielectric that we have discussed, you can assume a perfect material and it will be very close to the perfect because of the sophistication of modern deposition techniques.